Hello, this is Theatre Voice and I'm Carol Waddis. Lucien Msamati is a British-born actor, director, writer. He was raised and educated in Zimbabwe, where in 1994 he was a founder member of Over the Edge, the country's first multiracial professional theatre company. He moved to the UK in 2003. I first saw him, I believe, in Lynn Nottage's Fabulation at the Tricycle, although Lucy and I think actually it may have been a little bit earlier than that. But wherever it was, he made an immediate impression on me. I saw an actor before me who had weight, sincerity, and superb timing. Since then, he's followed it up with a host of other plays, including The Overwhelming, Present of an Empty Room, Morning Becomes Electra at the National Theatre, the Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, the lead role in the RSC's Pericles, and I think the last thing I saw you in, Lucien, was Ruined at the Almeida last year.
Yeah.
Welcome to Theatre Voice.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. What is it? First of all, let's talk a little bit about Clybourne Park, because this is what you're appearing in now.
Yes.
But of course, the other thing is that in November, you were appointed the new artistic director of Teatri for Hudsey. Which is the Black British Theatre Company, founded in 1987 by Femi Elofawuji Jr.
Yes.
And so we're going to talk about that in the second part of the interview. But first of all, Clybourne Park, in which you play the husband. Well, it's quite a difficult scenario to talk about.
Yes.
But let's just say that it's a spin-off from Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun.
Yes, that
would. Do you want to describe just the part that you play?
Well, I play two characters in two different eras, in 1959 and in 2009. One is, in 1959, a man by the name of Albert, who is the husband of the maid to the Stola family. And in 2009, I play Kevin, who is the, I suppose you could say, the yappy-bappy husband of the new head of the Residents Association in the in Clybourne Park version 2009. So, yes, two very different men, but who play a very similar role.
And it's basically, isn't it, to do with the fact of, in the one instance in the 1959-ish,
mm-hmm.
the community, it's a white neighbourhood.
Yes.
And there's the possibility of a black family moving in. Which is the situation in A Raisin in the Sun.
Yes.
And Bruce Norris, the writer of Clybourne Park, has then turned that on its head. 50 years later, we've now got a community that's mainly inhabited by a black community.
Yes.
And a white yuppie couple who
want to move into this the new trendy up-and-coming, conveniently close to the city centre neighbourhood of Clybourne Park.
Which is Chicago, we should say. It's had the most enormous success since it opened at the Royal Court last year. Mm. When you were rehearsing it, did you all feel that, because it's won awards as the best new play or the best comedy, and were you aware when you were rehearsing it that you were in something which was going to have this kind of reaction or response?
No, not in the slightest. We were all very aware that it was a brilliant piece of writing, and that's why we all jumped at the opportunity to take part in it. But I don't think any of us were quite prepared for, well, certainly from the cast's point of view anyway, we weren't prepared for the amazing, overwhelming response that it received.
Why, when you were offered the script, what made you jump at it?
Well, I thought, first and foremost, the quality of the writing was exceptional. I also thought the subject matter was very, very relevant to modern Britain and in certain parallels, but just to the reality, the changing sort of socio-economical, socio-political realities of the age in which we live. And it was a chance to see, if you like, middle class hypocrisy or liberalism exposed for what it is, in one instance.
I mean, political correctness, I suppose, mm-hmm. is the word that kind of springs to mind.
Oh yes.
But I can remember in the 1980s when I was working for a magazine called City Limits, we were very hard on the way that words were used, and to be very careful how words were used.
Yes.
And over the last kind of 15 years, that has got transposed into this thing called political correctness. But its intention was actually to honour people, to respect people.
Absolutely. And it's amazing how quickly that becomes can become patronizing within itself. It becomes
a mask.
It becomes a mask for all sorts of darker, deeper issues.
Yes.
And I think what has been refreshing about Claiborne Park has been that it is essentially a plea for honesty.
That's interesting.
Certainly from my perspective.
From your perspective.
You know, it is about let's be honest about what actually is going on, because we all want to live in a happy, peaceful, prosperous society, but all that comes at a cost.
Yes.
And, you know, it is funny how when the money in your pocket is threatened, that all of a sudden one's values come to them.
Absolutely. But what should we... I mean, you're saying that you think one of the issues of Claiborne Park is to do with honesty.
Yes.
I had a couple of other thoughts. I mean, one was that it was a kind of... it was guilt, in a way. It was the legacy of war. And,
absolutely.
Of course, the other thing is that there is this tour de force in the second half, which is all to do with bad jokes, or the kind of jokes that nobody really... How did you rehearse all of that? I mean, because it is what we're all... what we're all thinking. It is what goes on because of political correctness, or because we're trying to be nice to each other.
Yes.
The thoughts that go on in people's heads. But in this day and age, they wouldn't want to say. And that's true here in Britain as
absolutely.
Much as it is true in the States,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely, yes, yes. I mean, there was no... I think when it came to the to actually rehearsing that particular section... It wasn't that difficult. I think what the difficulty was the build up to it, because there came a point in rehearsals. I remember sitting around the table in discussions where, you know, I think it was Martin Freeman who basically said, "Well, you know, I'm worried that my son is going to go to school, a school into which he is." Where he's the only white child, and I, at the same time, I say that cringing inside, but knowing that, you know, I'm the most right on person there is, and yet, you know, suddenly this my frontiers are threatened.
Yes,
you know, and I was also struck again, but and perhaps having because of what I had done previously, that there were a lot of barriers that I didn't think existed. But that were in fact in evidence and needed to be broken down, even within, you know, the confines of a very safe, happy, arty rehearsal room.
Well, of course,
And there was we had to have an honest conversation in order to be honest about the reality of the story we were telling.
Was that painful at all at any time?
No, not painful. I think I was frustrated, and I suppose shocked and surprised that people. weren't dealing with it head on, and at the same time, I qualify that by saying that, you know, Dominic was also the director. Dominic Cook was also very insistent that it's first and foremost we're doing a play, so let's not get sidetracked by discussions that are all well and good and interesting, but effectively we need to make the drama that we have before us work. That's what's important.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and absolutely right. You know, having intense socio-political discussions doesn't really help you say, "Can I have a cup of tea, please?" Better, you know. So, I think it was necessary. I think to be able to say that in the rehearsal room, because the issues that are discussed in the play are issues that are. Very relevant.
Yes.
And uncomfortable.
Yes. And uncomfortable, definitely. Have you noticed, has there been a difference in response with audiences from the Sloane Square Royal Court audiences and the audiences, because we're sitting in the Royal Room at the Wyndham's Theatre, in the heart of Theatreland, in the heart of the West End?
Yes.
It, I imagine that it couldn't be more different, because your audience is your third part, and yes. The audience is very important, isn't it?
Oh yes, it is. There is a marked difference.
What is the difference?
Well, I think on a practical level, first and foremost, because it's a bigger space, it takes a little longer for the story to travel, or for the laughs to travel, and so technically there are adjustments. On the other hand, I also think that the level at which the audience are co-conspirators is a lot less in theatre land than it is in Sloane Square.
Enlightened in Sloane Square. They would consider themselves an enlightened audience, wouldn't they? In the West End, you might get people just walking in off the street.
Exactly. And what has been interesting is that when people who start at the beginning of the first act, you hear the laughs, and then all of a sudden there's a lull, and we're very aware of the fact that we feel the audience going, oh, what's going on? Is this a comedy? It said comedy outside. It said, you know, but this isn't funny. It's making me uncomfortable, and I'm not sure whether I should laugh or you know. And
where does that point happen?
I think it's round about the time that when the character that Sophie Thompson plays, Bev,
yes.
When Bev first starts to talk about the trunk and about the having to move the box.
So that's in the first half.
That's right at the beginning of the first half. That's where suddenly the audience aren't sure what's going on. And then when Sam Spruill's character, Jim, the local vicar,
the local priest,
walks in, they don't know whether to laugh at this man, or is it possible for one human being to be so plastic?
And what about when the Carl character, brilliantly played, I thought, by Stephen
Campbell-Moore.
I thought he was a fantastic replacement for Martin. And Martin Freeman done a wonderful job at Royal Court.
Really, a brilliant replacement.
But he brings something slightly different.
But
they must be slightly appalled as that speech goes on. Well, in the first half,
I think that's where actually maybe the heart of the discomfort is that because he's so believable and likable, and
to begin with,
and then all of a sudden, when by the time the audience twigs that, oh my goodness, he's actually he might actually be a member of the Third Reich, in disguise, and here we were singing and shouting and agreeing with him. I think it's round about perhaps there that people go, oh dear, what does that say about me?
Yes. And in the second half, when you suddenly, a third of the way into the second half, when suddenly Carl and he's called Steve in the second half.
Yes.
And his wife, the wonderful Sarah Goldberg, when unfortunately those jokes start to fly, is that when do you ever hear gasps from the audience?
We always do, and it's amazing because it is much more so here than it was at the West End.
Rather than in
Sloane Square.
Yes.
The extremes of reaction. I mean, people are really genuinely. It is as if there is a grenade.
Have you had anybody walking out?
Not that we're aware of.
No,
we've heard reports, but not that we've ever seen or noticed.
Right.
At that point, but I think, for instance, this afternoon, gasps alongside the laughter, alongside the sheer terror and horror of a very ordinary, civilized, quote-unquote, social situation going completely off the rails. And that is exciting to be a part of, I must say. And, you know, also, technically, it keeps us on our toes because we can't settle into a groove with this at any point in time. We always have to be listening and feeding off what is happening with the audience.
Now, I'm bound to say that those two roles that you play are fairly lightweight in comparison with the things that I've seen you in thus far in the UK.
Yes.
So, stepping aside a little from Clybourne Park, Let's talk a little bit about what you've done up until now.
Right.
What brought you back to the UK, and what was your life like in theatre in Zimbabwe or before you came here? Because you were a man of many parts there.
Yes, I was. If I'm entirely honest, it was all about ambition, really. You know, I mean, at a very young age, I had done all that there was to do in Zimbabwe. You know, we achieved all that we could possibly achieve. And we saw peers and friends and contemporaries all said to us, look, you guys are all wasting your ability here.
But what did you feel that you had done in Zimbabwe by that time? You'd set up your own company.
We'd set up our
company. You'd written
company,
plays, you'd acted
plays,
in them, directed them.
On
various issues?
On the issues of the day. You know, and you know, alongside doing Shakespeare, doing Arthur Miller, you know, we had done it all, and done it to a very high level, had been very successful, enjoyed all the trappings of fame, you know, as one might call it, you know, when everybody knows who you are and you walk down the street, or you know, things like that, which it would have been very easy in a relatively small country to sit back and go, well, you know, that's it. We're done now. But we all had this desire to sell ourselves and to sell our abilities to a wider audience, because we were continually shocked, and I remain shocked that people are, for the most part, quite ignorant of what happens on the African continent, you know. So as much as it was ambition, it was also the desire to reach the London's West End. I mean, this is, I think, entertainers around the world, and you know, in some way, you look to the West End, to Broadway, as being.
Does it still have that allure, do you think? I mean, when you're, now that you're here, sitting in this room, does it, now that you know what it's like from the inside?
I mean, that's an interesting question, because of course, with age, with experience, and You know all the things that you thought, you know, that suddenly there would be Saint Peter with his trumpet and with a glass of champagne welcoming you, saying yes, you've arrived. But you actually realize that, oh no, hang on, it's the job I've been doing all along, and actually it's another stop along a journey.
Yes,
you know.
Yes.
Although I must say, to step out onto Leicester Square and to see Clybourne Park in lights, and to see one's picture there, it does do something to me.
It
I must
does
say.
Mean something.
You know, it means, because I remember all those years ago, arriving in London for the first time and seeing these, myself and one of the company members, Shaheen Jassat, who is, you know, unfortunately died, very good friend of mine, and we arrived. It was a hot summer day in 1998, and we came out of Leicester Square Underground, and we were like, oh my goodness, we're in London, it's London, baby, yeah. And we saw all the theatres, and we saw the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane, and we ran up to it and stood outside the doors, and we were like, so near and yet so far, and we were all laughing and joking. And when I think of myself then and myself now, I think,
how old were you then?
1998. I would have been about 22 23, I think, right?
Okay.
Yeah,
yeah, no, that's young, isn't it?
I mean, oh,
that's
yes.
Full of enthusiasm.
Yes. Yeah, I mean,
things and ideals, dreams and dreams.
Yes.
To be done. And so your first thing you were saying to me that you know that you did here was at the Finborough Theatre.
Yes.
What an amazing little place. But it's a wonderful, wonderful space.
Oddly enough, we were having come over en route to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. We managed somehow. This was under the auspices of what was called Africa Dream Theatre, which was the brainchild of Bart Wolfe. Bart Wolfe, who was recognized as one of Zimbabwe's leading playwrights, actors. And he had been to Edinburgh the year before and had said, listen, I think you guys need to see this, need to be a part of it. And we each did one of his one-man shows in Rep. Anyway. And by hook and by crook, he managed to wangle a week-long run of these one-man pieces before sort of the pre-show to the show that was actually on, which was Judas Worm. I remember, I'll never forget, it was called Judas Worm. and so I think all of 12 people saw what we did in the end. But it was a test run, really, more than anything.
So if we push on from there, that was the beginning. If I was to ask you then, what was the next high point, do you think, that was pushing you on? Was it appearing then at the Tricycle in the fabulation with Jenny Jules, who you then went on to appear with in Ruin,
in
the Almeida, which was one of the finest plays of last year, in my humble estimation. Well,
thank you very much. I mean, there were several high points, but yes, I must say, being part of the very first Tricycle African American season, which was three plays over the course of 6 months, and to suddenly be in the company of Joseph Marcel, of Carmen Monroe, and Jenny Jules, who, round about that time in 1998-99, when we had gone knocking on the doors of various theatres, and Nick Kent very kindly had given us tickets to see her show, and I remember seeing this amazing actress.
Yes.
Absolutely amazing actress, thinking, my goodness.
Yes.
To walk into the rehearsal room and go, oh my goodness, it's her.
Yes.
You know, and then to have had
such
an amazing time over those 6 months, and to then have shared the stage with Jenny again on so many different occasions is, you know, I mean, but certainly, yes, the appearing at the Tricycle was a very big step up career-wise.
They have been fantastic. I mean, Nick Kent at the Tricycle has been amazing, the number of Black American, African American plays that he's brought in.
Yes, African
plays.
Yes, no, absolutely.
So, I mean,
absolutely.
Over the last kind of 20 years or so, he's really done it extraordinarily. Yeah. Mm. So there you are at the Tricycle. Mm. What was the next leap forward, do you think?
I think the next major thing was playing Pericles at the RSC.
Yes, so how did that happen?
Well, that was... Oh, goodness, now that's... I'm having to dig in my memory. I had been on a very good run of work over the course of those years, and Dominic Cook got in touch with my agent, and at the time I was rehearsing The Overwhelming. Mm. We had just started rehearsing
which
The Overwhelming,
which
was J.T. Rogers.
Which was at the National Theatre.
At the National Theatre.
Which was about...
Which was set in Rwanda, because it was... Just before the genocides in Rwanda in 1994,
yes.
Directed by Max Stafford Clarke.
Yes.
The amazing Max Stafford Clarke.
The amazing Max Stafford Clarke.
And I got the call to go and see Dominic. And so I went. And I had never met Dominic at that point. I'd heard of his name. I'd never met him. And I walked in and he said, well, I have an idea to do this particular story and to set it in a kind of an African setting, and I'd very much like to consider you for the lead. And I was floored, first and foremost, to think, wow, okay, well, that I didn't see that coming. Much as one might dream of it and hope for it or work towards it when it's actually on your, you know, so... And well, at the time, unfortunately, funnily enough, I said, well, thank you, but no. And that was because we were... Because of the Overwhelming contract, it was going to be 9 months in total, which would include the run at the National and a tour, a 4 or 5 week tour around the country. So, and I had already signed to that. So, you know, we, and of course, very politely and with regret, said, well, you know, we can't do this. To his credit, many weeks later, the phone call came again from Leslie, my agent, Leslie Duff, the amazing Leslie Duff, who said, well, they really want you to play Pericles, and they're going to fit the rehearsal schedule around the tour.
Fantastic.
And I think it helped.
Surprised.
It helped also that Pericles and The Winter's Tale were being done by the same company. And Dominic, you know, the plays are very, very similar in theme, and you know, the cross-casting of both was absolutely brilliant. And so Dominic's very simple but brilliant idea was that whilst I was on tour, they would rehearse The Winter's Tale, and then I would come back into London on Monday, have a day's rehearsal on Pericles, and then head off to wherever. Of course, we would have already had 6-7 weeks rehearsal prior to that, so it wasn't... You know, it wasn't all... it was all doable. It was all doable. And Yes, I mean that was quite an experience to arrive at the world-renowned Royal Shakespeare Company playing a lead.
Yes.
As well was quite something.
Well, I'm sure it was well earned. Let's just move on now, because we must talk, because in fact these interviews, as you know, are quite short.
Yes.
And I do, one of the main reasons for having you here, apart from Clybourne Park, is now to talk about your new role as the artistic director
indeed.
Of Theater Fahodozi.
Theater Fahodozi.
Theater Fahodozi. What does it mean? Does it mean in African? Does it mean in Zulu?
It's
does it mean
Yoruba,
theater? Does
and
it mean theater?
Yes, and it means it's theater of the emancipated, or theater the people. I know Femi will probably shoot me down, but I think that is essentially what it means. That it is.
And why have you taken it on, and what are your dreams for it then?
Well,
what do you think we're lacking?
Interesting question. I took it for a number of reasons. Firstly, because I wanted to get my brain working again, and that's on that side of the business. And for a while, I had been. As much as I have enjoyed success, and I don't complain or spit on it at all, but I do think that the opportunities remain quite limited for actors of a particular cultural background.
Right.
And so to be able to be in a position to change that, to move things on, was a challenge that I really, really wanted to...
Did they come to you, or did you ever
They did come to me, yes. Mm. And they had been... there had been quite a rigorous and extensive interview process before they came to me, and which I am again very flattered by. But and you know, I remember other friends of mine applying for the job and asking me my opinion on things. And you know, I know the board, who are all exceptional professionals in their own right, you know, really worked hard to replace, because Femi has built it from nothing really into a respected and established name. And so for the founder to step aside, you know, it was quite an awesome task to find a replacement. So I was approached, and I think after three interviews, I got the phone call saying I was the preferred candidate.
And so what are your ambitions for it?
My ambition is to move the company higher.
I mean, its emphasis is African-based.
Well, yes, our strapline, if you like, is Africans in British theatre, and you know, our mandate is to reflect, challenge, and to celebrate the cultural experience of Africans in not only in Britain but around the world, and through a medium of world-class entertainment, of world-class theatre. And the, you know, the high watermark for us certainly has been the Olivier nomination in 2010 for The First Wife, Iyaile, which was a co-production with the Soho Theatre. And so I have quite a task to match and hopefully better that. But my dream, actually, ultimately, is if I am able to one day stand at the Wyndham's Theatre and say... and see a Theater Fahodozi production here in the heart of London's West End, I think I'm happy to walk away then.
There haven't been many. There was one last year, which was the first one in the West End, wasn't there?
Yes.
The first black play, really.
It
would have made it into the West End.
You know, unfortunately, and this is part of a much wider debate, I feel as if that England, Britain... For reasons known best to itself, doesn't want to embrace the totality of all her children.
Mm.
Unlike the Americans. You know, the Americans open the doors and welcome everyone in.
Mm.
And you can be Italian-American, you can be African-American, you can be Chinese-American, but you are all essentially American, and that enriches the American experience. Whereas the English, the British, are not keen on that. And I don't understand why, particularly from a country that has had such an influence in the world, and that has such a place in people's imagination, in people's histories, you know. And if I can help to change that,
and do you think that will mean you looking for plays written by Black British or by African writers? Any idea about where you'll strike that balance?
Well, I think it's finding material that no one else would go for. So, for instance, if I can find the next great African playwright who is going to inspire generations and you know, add to the great canon of world theatre. Fantastic. But I wouldn't like to be so prescriptive at this stage. Just, you know, I would like to be open. I mean, we had a very successful production of Blue Orange, Joe Pennell's Blue Orange, the all female production.
Yes.
So it's, you know, as much as we have a very strong cultural identity, we are a theatre company, and theatre is our.
I mean, I remember in the 80s, again, when I was at City Limits, there were quite a few black British camera films,
yes.
And there was a particular one called Temba.
I've heard of Temba.
And Joe Marcel, actually, of course, would know quite a bit about the history of theatre and the black companies in England at that particular time, a lot of which have disappeared.
Yes.
For one reason or another. Sometimes
it's,
funding, sometimes perhaps just beating their head against a kind of a brick wall.
It's worth a whole documentary on its own, that, actually, because it's I think there's a certain generation of performers who have axes yet to grind with the failures of either of governments or of authorities.
And sometimes within, actually.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes.
Sometimes it's been
internal.
Oh,
of course.
But happens,
you know,
when you're a minority, doesn't
it? Exactly.
You feed on yourself.
Oh, yes. No, and, you know, I certainly don't. I'm not in the business of laying the blame at anyone's feet. I think we are all responsible and complicit in the demise or the triumph or whatever. I mean, yes, that might be altruistic, but, you know. I think the problem is, for me, is that when we start to apportion blame, we then get into the culture of guilt. And then we get into the culture of politically correctness and of political correctness, and everyone starts to overcompensate, and all of a sudden the quality of work, you know, suddenly, with no disrespect intended, but a company that may not necessarily have the best actors or the best writers will suddenly get all the money in the world because they tick a certain box, and that actually is completely defeatist, I think.
What do you think your criteria, when you had your own company, when you had Over the Edge in Zimbabwe, what do you think, what was your bottom line there? What was your criteria? I mean, you'll say to me, to make good theatre, but what in your terms in those days was good theatre?
You know, I would have to say it was being able to tell our own stories. And by that, I mean that we were a generation of young Africans, of Zimbabweans, who had grown up post-independence. So, of course, the memory of war, the scars, the strains of history remain constantly. But we went to schools with all different types of people. We were growing up in a world that was changing, and we wanted to be able to experience and celebrate and reflect our world, and not have a cultural label stamped upon us. And, you know, we weren't black enough, we weren't white enough, we weren't wrong enough, we weren't right enough, we were just a bunch of, you know, African kids who happened to like Monty Python as well as Oliver Tukudzi, and thought, well, you know, that's really, we like it, not because it's English, but because it's funny and we get it, and it appeals to us, and, you know, we want to be able to make our own.
Can you imagine writing your own material for the company?
Yes.
Tell your own story, or to would that be too much? I don't know. It must be difficult, actually.
You know, I mean,
artistic director. You
don't want
to be seen to be favouring yourself too
certainly
much.
Certainly not. No.
But Howard Barker's done that. If you think of Howard Barker's company, being played by Howard Barker.
Well, I think in that instance, you know, I suppose he has made no, when one makes no bones about that. I mean, you know, as much as Femi Elafowoju Jr., the founder of Jatafodzi, essentially put the company together as a vehicle for his own career.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
For him to direct work and to direct work that he wanted to direct, and similarly for us in Over the Edge, it was to be able to write and make our own work to serve us. In this instance, I think I would not be so arrogant, and the board wouldn't let me, I don't think, because we do have a mission and a mandate, and I don't think I could do my job properly if I was only serving myself, my own artistic intention. Though, you know, hopefully if I make a few award-winning shows, then I'll be able to get away with a bit more.
We're going to have to finish sadly. Will you come back and can I talk to you again when you
Absolutely.
When your program has been announced? But when do you envisage your first play?
Well,
I would
love for it to be tomorrow, but I think it would be fair to say we're aiming towards during the course of this financial year. So anytime between April of 2011 and April 2012 would be a very, very rough.
Well, when you've got your programme sketched out, will you come and talk to me?
Absolutely.
Again?
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.